record from my old radio station, and I'm glad I did it. It's a beautiful piece, Ceylon, for percussion instruments and electronic instruments and sound projection, recorded at West German Radio, April 14th, 1975. A 1970 composition by Stockhausen, inspired by the music of Sri Lanka, which was then still called Ceylon. Oh, that was released on Chrysalis in 1976, with another piece on the B-side called Bird of Passage. We'll hear next from Alvin Lussier, a piece called Ever Present. This is process music for flute, saxophone, piano, and slow sweep pure wave oscillator. So that's the wave oscillator is one of Lussier's favorite instruments. He uses oscillators on a lot of pieces. He's not particularly high tech in his processes, but his music is very challenging, and the decibel ensemble are up to it. All three members here perform on the software side of it, and Cat Hope is on flute. Lindsay Vickery is on piano, and Stuart James. Lindsay Vickery is on saxophone. Stuart James is on piano. And this is an Australian group, music recorded at the Music Auditorium of the Western Australian Academy of Performing Arts at Perth. This is a 2002 composition released on a CD called Still and Moving Lines on Pogus Productions. It's also downloadable. I've linked to the Bandcamp page for it on martiangardens.blog. This runs about 17 minutes. Alvin Lussier, Ever Present.
Thank you. is louder, I think. Turned up for you. Yeah.
Is this better? Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Thank you all for coming on this pretty lovely Saturday. You could be a lot of places, so really appreciate you coming here. Before we get started, I'd like to just do the Pledge of Allegiance. I want to acknowledge
live from Montgomery County today. We've lost the signal, but let's see if
you are. Appreciate you being here. My understanding too is that we have a World War II veteran here, Joseph Mastracco. Joseph,
yeah,
right here. Service, sir. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'll start off noting that this is Connecticut and Rhode Island combined, the third most rural district of any Democrat in Congress and the eighth in the entire country. So it is a big, big district. Since I've been elected. And we try to make sure about too much partisanship. I want to make sure people come together, have open, honest dialogue, and do so in a way that's civil. There's a lot of divisiveness going on right now across the country, a lot of ugliness, a lot of name calling, a lot of dishonesty. And at the end of the day, before we are Republicans or Democrats or independents, last time I checked, we're all Americans. And so for me, it's very important to do the work, get out, find that common ground. And to me, what is important about living in America and the work you're doing by being here in terms of being civic, having civic responsibility, is I owe it to you to be transparent. I owe it to you to be accountable. I owe it to you to be accessible. I think as long as I'm able to do that, at least in the first instance, we have the best chance possible to deal with some complicated issues. And I earn your trust, hopefully, along the way. I've not just done the town halls. I've made a point to make sure that we have physical space in every portion of the district. We have five district offices, Delhi and Delaware County, Liberty and Sullivan County, and we do mobile office hours. We'll come to you mobile if we can't, don't have a physical space in your county. If we don't have an office in Montgomery, but we are coming to you, and we'll be here to make sure we can access and you can access your needs and our services for you. The other piece I've been able to do, four locally based advisory councils. Every single county is represented on these committees, these councils, bipartisan, veterans, agriculture, small business, and healthcare. We've met repeatedly now. Now this helps me because it gives me the ability to actually connect with folks on the ground and actually take those ideas and those issues back with me to Washington. We have too much of a gap between what's going on in Washington and what's going on the ground. And it's important that I'm informed by the folks that I represent rather than informed by individuals in Washington. That's the key work. And if every single member of Congress actually did that work and went home and communicated with their constituents across the political spectrum, we'd be better for it. Because when we get back to Washington, we actually could do the work of the people and not just of a select few that happen to have access. That's critically important from my vantage point. Now, I've been busy, very busy, since being sworn in. It's only been 10 months. But it's felt a lot longer. We've had to endure quite a bit in these first 10 months, in my first term in Congress. As you all know, we are now undergoing an impeachment inquiry. I came out for that inquiry after the president admitted that he would solicit, or he was soliciting, the aid of a foreign national. That was not an easy decision, not in the least bit. I didn't run to impeach the president. That wasn't why I signed up to do this. In fact, I took a long time to get there. You know, I wasn't out there talking about impeachment during the Mueller investigation. But this felt different to me, particularly because it implicated our future elections, and particularly because the president is actually a sitting president at this moment. We are still undergoing and unearthing all the evidence. We just learned this past week that, as testified to by the Ambassador Taylor, there appears to be some evidence of a quid pro quo as well. Now, as I said when I came out, I didn't think that was actually necessary, but the fact that that actually might be in play as well is very troubling and disturbing. But we're going to keep doing that. But I'm not here to just sort of fan the flames of division, if you will, and harp on the issue that I know, you know, can be complicated and divisive for many folks. So for me, it's understanding that my job, I'm not on the Judiciary Committee. I'm not on the Intelligence Committee. So I don't even get a chance to actually sit in the current testimony. My job is to serve on the Ag Committee, the Small Business Committee, the Infrastructure Committee. Those are my committees, and those are the committees that I'm working on tirelessly on your behalf. And I need you to understand that there's actually work being done, and I'm trying to do that work to the best of my abilities. I got four bills that I've been working on that got through the House, which is a big deal, to actually get a bill, introduce it, have it pass the House. One of those bills, the Family Farm Relief Act, it passed the House, it passed the Senate, and was signed by the President of the United States. Only been six freshman members of Congress that they were able to get a bill signed into law. I'm one of those six, and I'm proud to say that that bill is going to help our small family farms. We all know that in this district we have a lot of farms, dairy, fruit, vegetable, small family owned. About 97% of all of our farms, 97% are family farms, and they are catching it right now with the trade dynamics, the tariffs, market consolidation, skyrocketing dairy price. It is crushing our individuals here at home and our family farmers at home. The Family Farm Relief Act would lift the cap on eligibility for access to Chapter 12 bankruptcy so you can get reorganized. Not go totally bankrupt, but reorganize, have some debt forgiven, remain operational, and then proceed. Better for it. It's relief. Not a cure-all, not a panacea, but relief for our family farmers, and it is now law. That's a big deal, and I think I'm proud to say that we're in a position now to help our family farmers moving forward. Relatedly, thank you. Relatedly, we got a lot of young farmers who are trying to access land, farmland. But because of the price of land and just sort of the dearth of access right now, there's a real need to figure out creatively how to help them get there. Well, right now, farming is not treated as a public service. I think it should be. I think when you grow food, it can be provided. Good in that. And if we can get farming treated as a public service, then when farmers or young farmers try to loan could be treated as a public service and they could seek out loan forgiveness and financing specific to public service as a result, making it easier for them to do what they love. I just made that bill, introduced that bill to the House. We're working on it to get it through the Senate, and hopefully it'll make its way through. So there's a couple things that I've been able to do in the farming space. I don't want to dwell on that. If you can ask any questions, I'm happy to do so. The other bill that I got through the House, small business bill, that would create a one-stop shop website for all of our 27,000 small business owners in our district, including the self-employed, to be able to go to one website, not 30, to figure out exactly how to comply with all the different regulations that come with doing business in this country. Now, Democrats and Republicans can disagree on how many regs are good and how many regs are bad. But we should not disagree on making it as easy as possible for folks to comply. But we'll do that, and I think that's exactly why it passed the House. The other bill that I got through the House, H.R. 1 was a big deal. Came out top of the year. Democrats introduced it. A lot of different things in the bill. For example, it includes independent commissions for drawing congressional districts, so we stop getting gerrymandered districts. When you allow elected officials to draw... when you allow elected officials to draw congressional districts, it's a little bit... Common sense tells us all. That doesn't make any sense. You know, there's a tendency, it's human nature, to want to do something in that sense that's going to favor the party in power. So take that power from people and allow an independent actor to draw. that are create districts that are more fair, more balanced, and will incentivize, key here, incentivize compromise. That are so safe because they're so red or they're so blue, either way, that the elected official has to only worry about somebody primarying them, somebody who's going to be more extreme than them, then they're not going to think about how to find common ground. They're going to think about, let's make sure that nobody can be more extreme than me. And that's where we are right now. We got too many elected officials in our ability to find common ground. A couple other things, so I don't want to forget the actual bill that I introduced as part of HR 1. There are a lot of goodies in HR 1. There's automatic registration, there's early voting, there's making election day a holiday. This is all a part of HR 1, which makes it easier for us to actually live up to our democratic ideals. But the people would make it so that any FEC report that is filed, which documents how much money you get and from who, includes on that same document if that donor is a lobbyist and for who that donor lobbies for. Because right now, you look up the FEC report, you just see a name, you see a dollar amount. You don't quite know who that name is, you don't know what they do, who they lobby for, you gotta do a little bit more digging. A lot more elected officials would be a little bit different in terms of how they accept their money and from whom. So that type of visibility. So I got that specific bill as part of HR 1. Bills that are going to get through the House. I've done, I think at this point, 26 bills. Introduced 26 bills. About 15 of those bills are bipartisan bills. Bills that I had to beat of those bills. I've done a bill, my very first bill, a veterans bill, veterans service disabled bill, which would extend the benefits to the spouses of service disabled veterans. Another bill that I did in the veteran space would make it easier for employers to do tax credits to not just hire veterans, but the spouses of veterans. PFAS up in Hoosick Falls in Petersburg. We know what's going on there with all the
I'm not sure they have enough rural broadband in Montgomery County. The signal keeps cutting out.
Doing the work to get out in front of this and protect our community. Well, I've got a bill that I introduced, a bipartisan bill that would require PFAS, this chemical, to be listed on the toxic release inventory so we know how to track it and how it's being used and to what degree. So if companies are actually using this chemical, well, we're aware of it because this chemical, by the way, causes thyroid.
Again, we're sorry that the signal keeps...
Pretty important to want to know who's using this chemical and to what degree. We saw the effect of that in Hoosick Falls in Petersburg. We're going to make sure we get a bill that gets out in front of it, and that's what I'm happy to do in the PFAS space. Opioids. I mean, I can't tell you how many horrible stories I've heard of folks who've had to endure loved ones because of an overdose. And we have got to get to a point where we treat this addiction like a disease. We don't criminalize the behavior. And right now, in the current law, there are no caps, none, on how many opioids or prescriptions you can provide to someone who's in need. But there are caps on the actual medication treatment when somebody is addicted. So buprenorphine, Suboxone. You have to seek out a special waiver to be able to secure the ability to prescribe those medications. It doesn't make sense to me that we don't put a cap on what we know is highly addictive, but yet we do put a cap when it comes to treating those who now succumb to that addiction. I want to change that. I introduced a bill with Tonko that does exactly that, lifts the cap on special waivers and allows folks, not just in the ER room, but the community of primary physicians to be able to prescribe medication. And I think that also goes to destigmatizing addiction in a meaningful way. I got a couple more things I'll talk about, and then I'm happy to do Q&A, but I want to make sure you hear the work that's being done, because sometimes it doesn't always get picked up. Rural broadband. Broadband access. I don't know how we can develop economic growth if we can't access the marketplace. I don't know how they can access the marketplace if we don't have internet, high-speed internet. And no matter where I go across my district, this district, that's what I hear all the time. Well, we did a big-time hearing. The FCC commissioner came down, Jeffrey Stark, he came down. We did all the testimony we could. I came back a week later to Washington, introduced two bills. The Broadband Speed Act, which would say to providers, hey, you got to give the FCC the information that not that you advertise to folks. You say we can get to this many speeds and we provided this much service. No, we need actual data to know for sure who has it and to what degree. Mm-hmm. Right now, they don't do that. They just provide what they advertise, not the actual numbers. Second, if you are going to provide internet and high-speed broadband, make it 100, at least 100 megabits, at least. Right now, 25 is the standard. That's not future-proof. You go 4, 5, 10 years from now, 25's not going to do anything for you. You might as well not have internet at that point. So make it future-proof, set a baseline of 100. The other piece, a lot of folks are called or are deemed served. You know, a lot of folks are saying, oh, we're in a community that's been served. Well, actually, because the state has defined it as such. For any number of reasons. Maybe the mapping was incorrect, but for whatever reason now, people are being deemed served when in fact they're not. But you don't have any recourse. We created a bill that would actually set up a fund for local communities to draw their own maps for the purpose of challenging when they've been deemed served. Because I've heard from too many folks who live in communities that are deemed served who aren't being served. And we need to change that fact as well. Rural America altogether. As I said, we are one of the most rural districts in the country. We have got to get to a point where we are allowing our small, local, rural communities more flexibility, more opportunities to take federal dollars with flexibility here, to find local projects, to coordinate on the regional level, whether it's sidewalks, whether it's redoing the firehouse, whether it's broadband, whether it's schools, whatever the case might be. But give the local rural communities more of an ability to take those federal dollars and invest it in the way that they know, from your vantage point, is.
Again, there is a lack of rural broadband in Montgomery County today.
That would allow any rural community that qualifies, and you qualify by that being a rural community, the ability to access these funds, I think up to $2 million, on an annual basis, and then take those funds when you then create opportunities and invest in the community to redevelop, revitalize the community as you see fit. We got to get sort of the cumbersome, overly sized, bureaucratic federal government out the way sometimes of the local communities that know the needs on the ground. And this bill, I believe, would do exactly that. Last point. I know you're waiting to ask questions, but I want to lay this all out. Last point, climate change, all right? It's a big issue.
Rural broadband is also a big issue.
Health of the soil is not well. You know, we have hail storms that could destroy entire seasons. And we've got to do a better job here as a country of wrapping our minds around this issue. And not just from the standpoint of it being a moral imperative, which I believe personally that it is, but also an economic one. An economic one. When we're struggling here to figure out what the next economic model is going to be, you know, we don't have the GE. My parents worked for GE, okay? We don't have the GEs and the IBMs like we used to have that were really a strong presence all throughout this part of the state. And we haven't really figured out since what the new model looks like. What are the new kinds of jobs that are sustainable that you can build a future? Well, I think it's going to take a lot of different pieces, but one big piece is tackling the climate change crisis and having a green jobs initiative, focusing on our transition to the green jobs space in a green economy. So I want to do a bill, or I've done a bill, that will commission the Department of Labor and Department of Energy to do a one-year study. What are the jobs that we have to fill and create in order to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050? What are those jobs? And how do we fill them? And then create a pilot program that funds community colleges, high schools, even our middle schools, and put money into those schools to make sure that we are training people for exactly those jobs. A very targeted, practical way that creates a green economy and at the same time tackles the climate change crisis. There are a lot of areas that we need to pursue in this vein, but this is certainly one. So, I will stop now. But I want to just thank you guys again for coming, and I'm happy to take questions. I only have one rule. And that is, if you ask a question or raise your hand to ask a question, that you actually ask a question. You know, sometimes people do monologues. And I just did the monologue. So.
And again, there is a lack of rural broadband in Montgomery County, and the signal keeps repeatedly stopping out.
Last cycle, or earlier this cycle, to help a bit with criminal justice reform. But a lot more work needs to be done. Here are some pretty... is substance abuse. We shouldn't have a system that criminalizes substance abuse. We need to make sure that those individuals who are struggling with substance abuse actually are treated and not incarcerated. Incarcerated is not the appropriate form. And I'm for that. I'm for drug courts. I'm for decriminalizing the behavior and the conduct and making it easier to figure out how we can help people through the addiction. The other piece, though, is we need bail reform, too. In many cases, on charges that aren't always based on good grounds. And then holding people without any real basis to do so. And ultimately putting them in the position where we're keeping them from their families, from their communities, and doing so because of the overcrowding to some degree, for lengths that are just unacceptable. They're just not, we shouldn't accept the lengths at which people are being held when they haven't even been found guilty of a crime. In fact, I forget the number at this point, but I think almost half of, don't quote me on this number, but I'll put it this way, a significant amount of individuals currently serving time, at least in the state of New York, have not been found guilty of anything because they haven't had their day in court yet. But yet, they're still in jail, waiting for weeks and months on end. And that's just not acceptable. Not in a country that deems itself the land of the free, due process. So we have to do better in that regard as well. Policing, you know, I think is also important. You know, as an African-American man, raising two little boys, you know, I have to constantly be mindful of the fact and educate them about how they have to deal with the reality that far too often unarmed African-American men are being killed. And we have to do better to empower our law enforcement. It's a tough job. Tough job. I had a family friend who actually who was a police officer who was paralyzed in the line of duty. And so I've seen it from both ends. It's a hard job. And we have to make sure that our law enforcement officers are trained at the highest level with racial bias training specifically. We all carry. We all have our tendencies. We all have built-in biases based on this country's history. Put that and make sure that we're preparing and training our officers to account for that. And not just our white officers. Our black officers, too. We all breathe the same air. We all take in the same toxins when it comes to racial biases in this country. And so I'm a big proponent of making sure that we do work in that space as well. Lastly, making sure that we are doing a better job reintegrating folks back into the community. If you serve your time, you serve your time. You know, we have to allow people to move forward with their lives, whether that's being able to vote, whether that's being able to find gainful employment. If you've served your time, you've served it. We should be better about reintegrating folks when they come home.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
The rural money that you talked about, the billions of dollars, would they be matching grants?
So the way it would work would be you'd have $50 billion that would be set aside. I think it's over a five-year period, right? So it's a five-year period. And then you'd have rural communities who would partner up, whether it's localities or towns would partner up on application to access those funds. And the beautiful thing about this is once you've made the application and you've been deemed a legitimate recipient of the funds, you don't have to reapply. It's a rolling fund over the life of, I think it's maxed at 5 years. So the way in which the funds can be used and the diversity of ends is up to the community at that point. And you have to have panels, you have local actors who dictate together, collaborate together, how to allocate these funds and do so in a way that meets the needs of the community on the ground. So it wouldn't be matching, it would be, you'd be able to use resources that are available to you on the federal level. Now there might be state funds or state grants that you could also use They wouldn't automatically just be a part of whatever those fundings are, but that wouldn't limit you from seeking out other resources as well, whether they're on the state level or the county level. This would be a separate fund set aside for easy access, right? The challenge sometimes is how hard it is for to connect the funds at the federal level to the needs of folks at the local level.
One other question.
Yes.
Medicare.
Yes.
Then you
I want to change that.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's messed up. I'm working on it, though. Just for those, you're right. Go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt.
So anyway, we have it taken out of our Social Security check. Then we have to pay another insurance company for everything that's not covered. Then, if you work, you get Medicare taken out of your paycheck. Isn't that double dipping?
Yes. The short answer.
How come they're getting away with it then?
Well, you know, that's a harder question to answer. I don't think it's appropriate. In fact, I just introduced a bill in the same vein where currently your retirement savings are used against you in order for qualifying or determining eligibility for subsidy, for low-income subsidies in the Medicaid space, in the Medicare space. Why is it that your retirement savings are used? You've already earned those, right? You've already done that. So you've already had the tax, all that. So now you're now being asked at the back end, right, in your golden years, to say, oh, wait a second, we're gonna also use that against you, even though you're now not earning income. To your point, another example of taxing and double dipping that we've got to stop. And I'm working on a bill.
You're listening to WGXC Acre at 90.7 FM. This is Representative Antonio Delgado live in Montgomery County.
Healthcare is a big issue, right?
Again,
opinions about the appropriate approach. I've introduced a bill called the Medicare X Choice Act. Note the word choice. This is a bill that would allow folks.
WGXC Acre at 90.7 FM.
A Medicare physician network. It would not take away those healthcare who like their private insurance, but what it would do is create a public floor. Currently, if you don't qualify for Medicaid or qualify for Medicare, right, if you don't qualify for TRICARE, you are beholden to a monopoly. And the monopoly is the private insurance marketplace. And the private insurance marketplace is driven entirely by profit. So the only way to course correct that is to put a floor within that private insurance marketplace and say, hey, you can keep doing what you're doing, but now you're going to have a competitor that's not for profit. And the way deductions are priced when you're not for profit and the premiums are priced when you're not for profit is going to be a lot different than when you are for profit. And that's going to drive down the cost of healthcare because there'll be a course correction in the marketplace. Again, if you like your healthcare as it is, you can keep it. But we are creating now an opportunity for folks to opt in to a more affordable choice. The other piece is we have to make sure Medicare can negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry. Currently, it can't, which to me is one of the most ridiculous facts to contend with in this country. That would be like any one of us deciding that when we are going to buy a car or buy a home, to just put aside our negotiating power and just take whatever the sticker price is. And yet, in this case, this is the governor who is supposed to be acting on our behalf, the people's behalf, that has all the full faith and credit of the people behind it, all that power. And the government just says, you know what? Don't want to exercise that power. Just take it as it is. Now, how does that happen? How do we get to a point where that happens? Well, I guarantee you the vast majority of us don't want that. I haven't heard a person yet, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, that says, that sounds right to me. Everybody understands that's just dead wrong. The only reason why it's happening is because the pharmaceutical industry pays for it to happen. And they buy politicians to write these kinds of laws. And that's why I don't take money from corporate PACs or special interest groups, right? The point is to make sure that I'm only beholden to the folks who put me in office in the first place. We need a lot more of that. Otherwise, we're going to be in a position where these types of laws stay on the books. Medicare X Choice Act gives Medicare negotiating power. Yes, sir.
You're talking about the Medicare. I belong to a group insurance, and last forever, and I got a special. I go to Albany Med for something. And then about a month later, I get they denied. In the meantime, they had paid before. I never had any problem denied. This is the first year twice now they've done it. And matter of fact, I go to the clinic here, and I've been going there, I don't know how long they've been there, 40 years. And, and they even denied it because I was surprised when they called. I can always remember the date because July 16th, it seemed like everything seemed to fall apart. They called, wanted to know why they wouldn't pay. So I go, I took call my checkbook. I said, no, I'm paid right to the end of November. They denied. Well, the time I said, I said, I'll get back. So I got a son that's a lawyer in the Albany area. Well, he works for the state anyway. It doesn't matter. He said, Dad, that's out of my line. He says, I can't help you. And I said, okay. I hung up. I called a friend. He said, call the office of the agency, which I've had. Well, they called, and I felt, I wish I had that lady's patience, but it took her an hour and a half to get this straightened out. But yesterday, I had to go back to the same doctor, which they denied. And that was the first thing I wanted to ask you when I came here. Well, I remember the secretary started with, I wanted to see your card, and I said, as I pulled it out, I said, I want, before you say anything, I said, I got a problem with this concern. The first thing she says, are you with Humana? I says, yes. She says, here's, I told him to sign. Did you read it? I said, no. Why not? I said, because if anything happened to go to Carl Martin Harding Mazzotti, I said, the hard hitters there, I said, they say they do something for nothing, and that's what I'll do. Well, they gave me whatever I had to do and everything. But my problem is this. They paid before, but I guess the contract, well, do they renew a contract? I don't understand how they sign contracts. No matter. How come they this year I've had the problem that they denied? According to the policy, I should go to any doctor, any hospital, and everything. I don't like to have this pendant swinging over my head, that's all. I didn't grow up with this generation, you know? Right.
Well, it sounds like, I want to make sure I get this right, but it sounds like you're saying that you've had difficulties accessing
rural broadband in Montgomery County?
Yeah.
You know, and you had to go through a lot of loops and hoops to get to a point where you felt like you could access them, right? And that's the problem, and this has been getting increasingly more difficult. Well, this is a couple of issues here, right? One of it is at the federal level, because a lot of this is, you know, coming from the federal level, we haven't prioritized improving Medicare. We haven't prioritized expanding Medicare. More than anything, really, in a long time. If anything, a lot of the budget cuts that would cut significantly Medicare. So we got to make sure that we're actually prioritizing Medicare, securing it, and ensuring the benefits there are accessible. On your specific issue, if this is something that is ongoing and you need help, I encourage you to reach out to Amanda Boonhauer, who's in the back right there. She's my district manager on your behalf to figure out what, if anything, we can do to get to the bottom of it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
All right. Yes.
You currently have a tax or a campaign finance system where the wealthy have a huge advantage over the common man such as us. Do you ever foresee where we can have a complete taxpayer-funded campaign system eliminating the influence of millionaires and billionaires in this country?
So great question. Great question. And I'm going to tell you why that's such an important question. The level of inequality right now in our country, income inequality, is at the highest level it's been at since we started recording it in 1967. So decades high. 0.1% of this entire country owns a fifth of all the wealth. 0.1 owns a fifth of all the wealth, while two-thirds of us have a $500 medical emergency bill without going into debt. And 95% is concentrated wealth in the hands of a very few. Now, when you combine that with the willingness of folks and the ability of folks to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence our government, to access our elected officials, what ends up happening is only a handful of folks and big corporations even have the ability at this point to influence electeds. And the vast majority of Americans, everyday Americans, are shut out of the system. And going back to the pharmaceutical example, that explains why, even though you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody in this entire country who would say, yes, Medicare shouldn't have negotiating power. I like it just the way it is. You can't find anybody. I haven't found anybody yet. Maybe this, but let's say there's two or three. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, most of us don't want that. And yet, because of the ability of that industry to pour millions and millions and millions of dollars into the pockets of elected officials, what we know ought to be the case is not the case. Now, we can't call that a democracy anymore at that point, because the will of the people is not being exercised. It feels more and more like an oligarchy than it does a democracy. So how do we change it? Well, going back to H.R. 1. A big part of H.R. 1 is a public financing piece, which would at least use taxpayer dollars to match individual dollars raised to a 5-to-1 ratio. I don't want to be in the position where, which is only a start, I think we need to go further. The one thing where I draw a line at is saying that individuals can't give to an elected official, because I think there is a political speech component to that. Like, I wouldn't want to say nobody, no individual can give money, because there's value in people, I think, actually understand there's value in being able to say, I individually want to back an individual who I believe in, who I support. It's a form of political. It's a lot different than a super PAC or a corporation that is not a person, right, having that ability. And we got to rein that in. And we got to. Allows for unlimited amounts of money to pour into our system, get overturned. But it's going to be hard to actually flip that kind of decision. It's also going to be very hard to pass legislation that gets us to public financing. I think it's going to be difficult. But what we can do, at the very least, is introduce measures that make it as easy. Because right now, people are not engaging either. And you can't erase a person's vote, but that vote has to happen. And money becomes a lot more potent when people are sidelined, right? When they can't be, they can't exercise their rights. So, like I said, automatic registration, same day registration, making sure that folks, the ability and the chance to exercise their right. That will not do away entirely with this issue. But I think it's a first step to starting to level the playing field. Because it's a battle between the interest of capital. And I'm a capitalist. I'm not here to disparage capitalism. But capital cannot just overwhelm democracy. It can't just be the primal mover when it comes to how we promote the general welfare. What ought to be the primal mover is our values, equality, equal opportunity, right? Freedom. These are things that we have to prioritize before anything else. And I. Yes?
Two questions.
Yes?
First question, can something be done? Because I don't feel politicians should. Something that people
hold on. I like that idea.
Themselves.
So the question was about politicians giving a raise. Well, I don't think Congress is, I don't know the exact, it's been a while since Congress actually has done that. Yes, New York State, but I'm talking about, you're right, but the federal level, I think it's been a little while. But to that point, when we had the shutdown, I'll get your second question too, but when we had the shutdown, right, like I'd imagine all of you, I was disgusted by it. We our job is to govern. We are miserably failing at our jobs, us elected officials, if we can't keep the government open in order to govern. That's a baseline goal. Right? You have to keep the government open. Otherwise, why are we there? You might as well just go home. And so, that would say, rather than shutting everybody out and shutting all the agencies down and denying you services and benefits as a result, and also denying pay to our federal employees, what we ought to do is take the compensation of legislators, those in the Congress and then the executive, put it in an escrow account, and we hold it there until we figure it out. So rather than saying, you have to suffer while we mess up on the job, we have to suffer until we figure it out. Now, I was for that, but I'll be honest, it was hard to find enough people in Washington. But I was for that, and I think, to me, that's the kind of mentality we have to do right by the people. No, you're absolutely right. And yes, we need a lot
All right, again, there's a lack of broadband service in Montgomery County, and the signal is repeatedly breaking up, breaking down, and fading away. So,
and no one wants to show how the pricing happens because it's a competitive marketplace. And so there's a, you know, intellectual property issues. People say, well, if I reveal too much, then my competitor might know X, Y. If you have a nonprofit actor in the world, right, as a public option would create, at the very least, you'd have a benchmark. And you could say, okay, well, here's how this nonprofit actor is working. And we can compare based on that nonprofit actor how the other interests are working. But even beyond that, if you look at, for example, some of the laws we have in the books when it comes to generic brands and prescription brand name prescription drugs, right now it is legal for generic brands or brand name drugs to pay off generic brand companies to keep their products on the shelf, right? To be able to keep jacking up the price at our expense. It's also very difficult for generics to seek out through the legal process copycat samples so that they can begin to make the generic. And so now the brand companies make it more and more difficult. There's some bills that I've worked on that'll make it easier for those generics to actually take those brand companies to court of paying generic brand companies or generic companies to shelve their products. Same vein, we're the only one of the few companies or few countries in the world that allows for advertising of pharmaceuticals. I mean, this is an issue for me that is a curious one. Because at the end of the day, it's being used for advertising and to sort of convince people of their ailments and, you know, sell to people how they need to actually find and use this product. First of all, it sounds like drug dealing, right? Just in a very, you know, cleaned up fashion. But then, how about if that money was actually used for research and development to actually place so that people can benefit from it? The budgets, when you look at the budgets of some of these pharmaceutical industries and what they're spending their profits on, we're talking significant amount of that money that they earn is being spent on advertising, on convincing the consumer, you need this, you should take this. I say take that money, reallocate it into research and development. Yes?
I have a couple questions.
Your Medicare X plan?
Yes.
Some of the Medicare for All or universal coverage plans expand Medicaid to cover more services that are not covered by Medicare. Is
yes.
What I've been meaning all along. To cover more things that are not covered by Medicare right now, such as dental, vision, and
yes.
especially long-term care.
Yes.
Does your Medicare X plan expand it to cover these services?
Absolutely. It has to. Otherwise, because right now Medicare is constructed in a way for, you know, 65 and old, right? It's a certain demographic.
Right.
And
but
so
not
it makes
long-term
sense.
Care.
Right, there's things that aren't included in Medicare, you know, that you would have to include. And we use an ACA standard of benefits, a baseline standard. The ACA covers the physician network, right? The Medicare physician network to those folks who also have a ACA, benefits package. So that's it's just blending the two worlds together. And actually,
ACA doesn't cover long-term care, though.
Yeah, but there are certain plans that do that are offered that you can include as part of the package. Yes.
Okay.
I can't. So
well, not in this state.
And then the other piece. Well, if it's state, yeah, it might be different on the state. But the other piece of this to understand is because you mentioned the piece. Because whether it's Medicaid or Medicare, right? At the end of the day, there's always a gap.
Yes, there is a lack of broadband service in Montgomery County. That is the lesson we take from today as Representative Antonio Delgado's town hall meeting there continually interrupted by lack of broadband service.
To qualify for something like Medicaid, because the gap between actually, you know, trying to pay for the health care is too much for you. Act, my bill would do away with that cliff.
So it would allow people to buy into Medicare?
Well, not only that, but it would increase the subsidies, right? So that people who are over, that there wouldn't be a cap. So we'd say, instead of the cap at 400, we'd say no one should spend more than 12-13% of their income, which is high, but no one should spend more than that when it comes to their premiums and their health care costs. Same vein, for those who fall below that 400%, there's more credits that are provided. So it makes the health care system as a whole more affordable and allows people to secure benefits in a more affordable fashion. So there's different levels to it.
It keeps the complexity, whereas universal health care makes things extremely simple. No more claim forms, no more denials. As the lady over there was saying, you don't know what you're getting into when you go to the doctor these days. And
well,
no,
I think it's a valid point to note that you want to.
Time saves money, obviously.
I totally agree. In fact, the administrative costs of a private insurance claim relative to a Medicare claim is 7 times higher. Mm-hmm. 7 times. So you're right, there's built-in cost savings when you have a nonprofit actor in the mix who doesn't have to give up. But I think it's also important to understand that leaving it or putting it in the hands of the government, right, entirely, is not as easy as one would think. I mean, it's an incredible undertaking to piece apart or take apart a system that we now know is incredibly complicated and complex, particularly when you think about the nature of just the jobs, just the magnitude of jobs. Hospitals, for example, are the biggest employers in this district, right? So understanding and grappling with sort of how we account for the unraveling of a system that is incredibly structural change, make bold change, but do so in a way that allows us to sort of gauge the impact and gauge how we respond, how the market responds. The other piece is, you know, it is important to figure out how. Well, there are unions, you know, teachers' unions, for example, who negotiate their health care packages. Well, you have other individuals for various reasons who like the care they're getting in a certain situation. It is not comforting to certain people across the country when you tell them, hey, you know what, the cost of healthcare is going to go down. Your costs are going to go down. That assumes everybody's costs are going to go down. Not everybody's costs are going to go down. Some people actually have really good healthcare by virtue of any number of different reasons. And so just telling them your it's going to vary from person to person. And I think allowing that flexibility and giving people that choice to keep what they like it, but if they want another option, they can. Divided political climate and give us the best chance to actually get something that we can pass and make change on a very important issue.
Thank you.
Congressman, we're about out of time.
Okay, I'm going to follow up. You can make a statement as long as it's brief.
My brief statement is on political ends, different ends of the spectrum. But by listening to you speak, you've earned my respect.
That's a nice statement. Okay. Thank you. You told
and with thank this young lady, I used to be a funeral director. To the funeral home to make arrangements or just ask about pricing. We had to give them a price list. And we had to go over everything there was. If we didn't give them a price list as soon as they came in, the funeral home would get hit for the fight. There would be FTC people posing as, you know, bereaved families, and they would leave and not say anything. 2 months later, 3 months later, they'll be like, and what they have a Democratic guest, they have a Republican guest, and no matter what the issue is, you know beforehand what that person's going to say.
Yes.
Okay? When you vote, okay, do you take into effect, I know you do because I'm listening to you, but okay, you would take into what your constituents think and not what your party thinks.
Yes.
Okay. And my last question is, do you believe that that secret hush fund that's in Congress or the Senate for, like, sexual abuse should be released?
Yes.
Thank you.
There should be no secret slush fund. There should be taxpayer dollars, first of all.
Yeah.
The notion